So yeah, then the question I always hear is, Pastor Eric's not here. Who's preaching today? And I'm excited to tell you today, we have our very own Greg Schmidt. Woo! is gonna bring the message, and I just have appreciated the Schmidt since I got here, and it's been my pleasure to get to know Greg in a number of ways, including what we got to spend yesterday together with the homeless, among other things that he's done to minister to us in our community. And with that, we'll turn it over to Greg.
Am I on? Oh, I am on. Whoa. Well, today I'm a little bit nervous today. And it's not because of speaking in front of a group, because I've spoken in front of groups of 200 and 300 before, and that wasn't really an issue. But the topic, I've been praying about this, and I'm a little bit nervous about the topic. Because most of it is about my life. And I don't want it to be about my life as much as I want it to be about the victory that God has given me and some of the things that have happened to me in my life. So I've led a pretty blessed life. And like all of us, there are things in my life that have been difficult at times, that have been hard on me and hard on my family. And I want to share some of those things with you, not to impress you or to make you feel sorry for me or to boost my ego. Instead, I want to just share with you about the profound grace that God's shown me in my life and how I've had victory over some things as a result of prayer and God's grace. So I want to start with my relationship with my lovely wife, Donna. And I told her I wasn't going to embarrass her, so I'm working hard not to do that. I probably just did that. So Donna and I first met in August of 1979 in the dormitories at Southwest State University. She and I were living in what were considered technically separate buildings, but they were connected, and we were on the same hallway. So she was probably 60 feet down from where my room was, and we hung out together for a while, and then we started kind of being a little more formal and spending a lot of time together, probably more time than we should have. And in June of 1981, we went to a wedding in Fulda, Minnesota, and it was two friends of mine that were getting married in Fulda. And on the way home from the wedding, we broke up. During the wedding, I was thinking, man, this is romantic. We could be doing this here pretty soon. And the way home, we broke up. And it was the right thing to do. It's just that I was not that excited about it at the time. And it was because I was really selfish. I was requiring too much of her time, more than I should have been asking. And it took me a while to figure that out. Over the next couple of years, we saw each other occasionally. I think in the first year we saw each other several times. The next year we saw each other a little bit less. And in year three, we saw each other even a little bit less. And in the spring of 1984, I think it was probably in May, I sent a letter to her, and I was pouring out my heart to her and trying to convince her that we should be together and whatever. The letter got returned to me, because there was nobody at that address with that name. And I was kind of panic-stricken. I thought maybe that's finally the end of it. And so I sent the letter to her mom and dad, and I said, would you please forward this to Donna? And they did. And then in July of 1984, Donna came down to see me. I was living at my mom and dad's lake place in Mankato, or not in Mankato, but 12 miles from Mankato, and she came to see me, and that day we agreed to meet in her hometown in Morgan on Saturday. So we went to Morgan. I went to Morgan, and this might not be a precise quote, but when they make the movie about our life, these will be similar words to what they say. She said that she was interested in us dating again. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I said, but I wouldn't want to just date. I'd want to get married. And she said, okay. So again, I don't know if those are precise quotes, but they're pretty darn close. And obviously very, very excited about that, and trying to maintain a sense of calm, even though I wasn't very calm. But it was the words I wanted to hear, and I had tried to spend that 3 years in between trying to grow up a bit and show her that I was worth spending my life with her, or her life with me. So a year later, in August of 1985, we were married. So we've been married for almost 37 years. And that was definitely an answer to prayer. And I thank God every day for my relationship with my wife. So that's the first one. That was a tough time. And I was living in Iowa, and she was in Minnesota. And yeah, it was... But we both came around. So my next topic is about children. So we got married in 85, and by 1988, we had decided we wanted to have kids. We thought we were kind of qualified. We had both had education degrees, and we had grown up in larger families. She was one of six. I was one of seven. And so we were both the third child of those families, and so we knew how to get along with people because we're the... So we wanted to have kids. And from 1988 to 1991, it wasn't happening for us. And I was at one time a biology major and a health and phy ed major, so I knew what was supposed to happen and how it was supposed to happen. But it wasn't happening for us. And so we thought, again, God wants us to have kids, so we started looking into foster care and adoption at that time, kind of simultaneously. And then November of 91, I was out running. I used to be a competitive runner and distance runner, and I was out running in Mankato, and I went past the Salvation Army store, and there was a van sitting out there that was for sale. Well, the next day we bought the van, the minivan, and it was seven passengers. And by the end of the summer of 1992, so about 7-8 months later, we had five children. So we had a 13-year-old named Josh, we had an 11-year-old named Brad, we had a 9-year-old girl named Jenny, and we had infant twins, Paul and Heidi. So we got a bunch of kids pretty quick. And I look back at that and I think, well, it's good we had them ahead of our own children because we got to practice on somebody else's kids. But we've had a heart for children since day one, and by 1993, early in the year, Donna was pregnant with our first child, and Haley was born on December 6th of 93. And we still had Paul and Heidi, who were not even two yet. And we were pretty busy at that time. We were busy for a long time with foster children. But and then in 1997, Lindsay was born on March 10th. And then on January 8th of 98, Courtney was born. And she came to our house as a foster child on November 16th of 98. She was about 10 months old. And then we adopted her about 9 months later on August 11th of 99. So we had our third daughter. And then in 2001, Abby was born. She was born on July 17th. And Abby came to live with us the day before 9/11. So when a lot of people were thinking, oh no, look at those towers and all the sadness that went with that, we had this little baby that we could hold. And that really helped me through that other stuff, just to know that we had this little girl to take care of. So we had our fourth daughter, and then we adopted her on July 11th of 2002. So she was just a few days short of her first birthday. And then I had surgery so we wouldn't have more children. And... I'm not going to describe that to you. But there was a time that I really thought that I wanted five kids. I have no idea where that number came from. I don't know if God spoke that into my heart. But I wanted five kids, and it was done. We were done. My wife had said that we have enough children. We're done with kids. My daughters kept bugging me about having a little brother. And I said, you got to talk to her, because she's the one that's kind of put the kibosh on that. And I don't mean to disrespect my wife in this matter. We had four kids, and that was really probably plenty, except God had a different plan for us. And one day my wife was home and I was not, and she got a phone call from the licensor at Nicollet County where we had lived. We lived in North Mankato. We lived in the Mankato area for 20 years. We lived in North Mankato for 15 in the same house. And then when we moved to Clara City for me to take a job as a superintendent, she got this phone call out of the blue. And during the phone call, she said something similar to, "So are you offering this little boy to us?" And the licensor said she was. Well, it turns out the little boy was Abigail's biological sibling. And most of you know him as Alex. So during that phone call, Donna said that yes, we would take that little boy. So I wasn't part of the conversation. I wasn't part of the decision. But she accepted him. And I felt like, wow, that was cool. That was the second big decision she made. One other time I was in Boston. I was in Springfield, Massachusetts. And she asked me if we could buy this house. I had never seen the house. And we put earnest money down before I got home, and we bought the house. So I trusted her, and I trust her. But yeah, she made the decision about Alex without input from her husband, and it was the right decision. Because we've been totally blessed with Alex, and we've been blessed with our other kids. So again, we have, in addition to our five children, we were foster parents for 12 and a half years, and we had about 30 others that we got to help take care of for a period of time. And Paul and Heidi, those twins that I just mentioned a little bit ago, we had them for 3 years, and they just turned 30 last month. But they were babies. They were 3 months old when they came to live with us. So we saw them quite a bit after they left us. For probably the next 6 or 7 years, we would see them every other month or so for the weekend, and they would come over. And so on their birthdays the other day, I texted one of them. I don't have the other one's phone number, but Donna texted them both. So we still have a little bit of connection to them and try to do that. So, and as many of you know, we now have 3 grandchildren and 2 more expected later this year. And so, again, I thank the Lord for that. Because again, it started out that maybe we couldn't have kids, and all of a sudden we had a bunch, and we like them. We like them all. Even Alex. So my next little section is called My First Family, and that's my brothers and sisters and my mom and dad. Some difficult things have happened there, like every family. I'm not telling you anything new. But one of my brothers, at our house, we were having a birthday party for Paul and Heidi. It was their first birthday. So it was the first birthday party we were having for kids in our home, in our lifetime. And that day, my oldest brother wasn't able to come to the party because he had National Guard training that weekend. So he was up at Camp Ripley, and we had this party, and lots of people came, people from our church and my siblings, my parents, a bunch of Donna's family, a bunch of people came to our house that day. And when everybody left, we were home by ourselves, and about 10 o'clock or so, there was a knock on the door. And it was my younger brother, Jeff, the one that we do homeless stuff together. And he told me that my oldest brother was killed in a helicopter crash earlier that day. And it was a hard thing to hear. It seemed surreal because I'd just seen him the day before. He was coaching track with me at Mankato West. I was the head girls track coach, and he was one of my assistants. And yeah, it just he was gone. And we didn't know it that day. Well, so that was Paul and Heidi's birthday, my brother's death, and my grandfather's birthday, all on the same date. And we didn't know it that day, but my mom had been diagnosed with cancer. She didn't tell anybody right around then. She was waiting a good time to tell us, and then my brother was killed, and so she put off telling us for several months because she didn't just want to add to the confusion or whatever. And but that was kind of like the second bad thing that was happening. And even though cancer is treatable, and it was treatable back in 1993, you know, lots of people, when they hear the word cancer, they kind of just fear the worst. happening, and I think a lot of us felt kind of like that. And then the next year, I think in April, one of my brothers was diagnosed with HIV. And that was kind of the early days of HIV, and I think at that time people were believing that that was a death sentence, almost certainly. And so, again, three kind of bad things that happened in a short period of time. And but people prayed for the people that were still living, and my mother had cancer, I believe, four more times between 1993 and 2013, but she lived 20 more years as a productive adult and after her first diagnosis and went through the chemo and radiation for those things in between, and again, had a good life for 20 more years. So we believe that prayer had a lot to do with that, and competent doctors and so on and so forth. My brother, who was diagnosed with HIV in 1994, if you saw him now, you'd say, that guy has HIV? Because he's quite healthy, and his viral load is classified as undetectable, which means it's so minute that it's some parts per million or whatever, I don't know, but it's they classify his viral load as undetectable. And I think one of the things that probably was helpful to him, in addition to prayer, was the fact that he became part of the National Institutes of Health's longitudinal study. So he got the best treatment that was available and gets checkups regularly up in Bethesda, Maryland. And he lives in Virginia. To tell you how healthy he is, he's turning 63 in a few days. But when he turned 60, he decided to do an Ironman triathlon. And those of you that aren't familiar with Ironman triathlons, you swim 2.4 miles in the ocean. You ride your bike. You get out of the water. You get on your bike and you ride for 112 miles. And when you're done with 112 miles, you run a marathon, which is 26.2 miles. You do all that in a row. Yeah, you can rest. You can stop and walk. You can stop your bike and drink some more water or whatever, but it's all in a row. And he did that when he was 60 down in Panama City, Florida. And he actually had a faster time than when he did the Ironman triathlon in Hawaii back when he was 27 years old. So again, if you saw him, you'd say, that guy has HIV. So again, lots of prayer, lots of grace from God, and we're happy he's still around, and it's fun to see him. He comes home quite often, actually. He came home five times in 2021. So just a real quick one on graduate school. I guess I'm going pretty fast. We can get through this, all right. Well, I'm almost halfway done already. So I went to graduate school. Donna and I had been married for a year. We were living in Iowa in a little town called Bode. Bode, Iowa is where Dallas Clark came from. Anybody know Dallas Clark? Do you recognize that name from football? He was a receiver for the Indianapolis Colts when Peyton Manning was the quarterback. Dallas was one of his favorite targets. I knew Dallas when he was 5 years old, however tall he was then. His brother Dan was in my Boy Scout troop. I was a scoutmaster down there. And so I know a professional football player. Not really, I don't know him, and I haven't talked to him since. I left that town in 1986, but Bode, Iowa, he's from Bode, Iowa. You look it up on Google and you'll see that he's from Bode, Iowa. My son didn't quite believe me the other day, and he started looking into it, and he says, God, Dad actually did know him. So anyway, I started graduate school in 1986. I wanted to become a principal. So in order to become a principal, you have to have a master's degree, and I gave some thought at the time to becoming a superintendent, and in order to do that, you have to have a degree beyond a master's degree. So I went to graduate school to do that, and over the course of the 2 years that I was there, I took all the courses that I needed to take to get both of those degrees. And a funny thing happened after I actually left the college. I mean, I had an office there because I was working there also part-time as a graduate assistant. And I left the college, left my office, and went home and got really busy with life. And didn't finish either of those degrees. I had taken the thesis credits for my master's degree and the thesis credits for my specialist degree, and never actually finished those courses, if you will. Again, they were papers, but I didn't finish either one of them. And about 7 years into that adventure, so I had been away from graduate school for 5 years, I went to the registrar's office and I said, you know, I got these credits and I haven't finished these. How do I finish them off? And the guy said, well, it's too late. You're outside of that 7 year window that you have to finish that degree. And I was like, oh man, that was kind of a bad choice. So in 1997, about 4 years later, I started doing it all over again. And my father was instrumental in me being successful in that, because my earthly father and my heavenly father, but my father helped finance a big chunk of that graduate school for me. And I finished my master's degree in 2003, and I finished my specialist. Actually, I finished a sixth-year certificate, which is the equivalent of a specialist degree, but it was a little bit different. I finished that in 2004 and actually went to the graduation in 2004, because when I had graduated from Southwest State, I wasn't able to go to the graduation because I was coaching track in Canby, and we had a track meet that day, so it didn't work for me to go to the graduation. So I went to the graduate school graduation. I went to graduation in the spring of 2004, and there were a couple thousand people graduating, and I was literally about the third or fourth person to go up on the stage. And my family was sitting way up in the bleachers. We were in the hockey arena in Mankato at the Civic Center. They were way up there in the corner, but my wife and my daughters were up there, and I got my two diploma things and went down and sat in my seat and just started bawling like a baby. It was so emotional. It had taken me 18 years to go from point A to point B. So I kind of look at that as a little bit of perseverance, but again, God's grace, obviously, because it was kind of a big deal at the time. And again, I was very, very emotional about it. I didn't think it would be that big of a deal, but it was a big deal. So, and now it's been 18 years since that happened. It's like, the older I get, the faster it goes. And my next little topic is about employment. And my script here starts in 1990. But starting when I left college, undergraduate school at Southwest State, I had 9 jobs between the spring of 1982 when I coached track in Canby to 1990 in the fall when I started working for a software development company in Mankato. I had 9 jobs in that short period of time. And but in 1990, I was coaching girls cross country at Mankato West. I was unemployed at the time. Actually, I was working part-time at a Catholic school teaching mostly history, but then I was also doing catechism for them at night. I'm teaching Catholic kids about sexuality and stuff like that. And I've never been Catholic, so I'm not sure how they hired me, but they did. I had a health education degree, so I knew about that stuff. I just, whatever. So I was coaching, and I had a lot of success coaching. It went really well for me, and I think once I got my head out of my rear end, and figured out that it was really about the kids and not me, my teams had even more success. And I was coaching a girl named Rachel, and Rachel Johnson, and Rachel's father was the owner of a software development company in Mankato called Clearwith Computers. They developed software for people in dealerships that sold expensive equipment, trucks, tractors, all kinds of ag equipment, all kinds of construction equipment, heavy-duty trucks, medium-duty trucks, anything you can think of that you see out there that's bigger than what you have at your house, they had software for it. And what you could do is you could go into the dealership and you could say, I want to buy a semi, I want to buy a tractor and with a trailer. And they would customize the semi. You could order the semi however you wanted it, whatever interior color you wanted, you know, this feature and this feature, this feature. And in those days, they didn't have, they had people actually drawing all of those interiors. And then the software would, again, if you selected red interior, then that screen would pop up. They could show you what the inside of the truck looked like, show what the sleeper area looked like. You could, all of that stuff. But it was all hand-drawn. It wasn't the kind of technology they have now to do those kind of special effects. So anyway, I was coaching Jerry's daughter, Rachel, and she went from this little, the way that it was explained to me, she went from this little timid mouse-like girl to this confident little fire plug. She just wanted to be good. And I think Jerry was impressed by that and thought I must have had something to do with that. So he contacted me one day. Again, I was working part-time. He contacted me and said, you know, I'd like you to come in. I'd like to talk to you about a possible job. I said, sure. So I went in and talked to him, and he had some big shots in the company come and talk to me. Actually, at that time in the company, I think there were only about 70-some employees. Well, I worked there for 4.5 years, and at the end of that time, there were 350. And out of all those employees that had come to the company since I joined, I did new employee orientation for all of them. So I knew everybody. I didn't know them well. I didn't know them intimately, but I knew them. And it was a good experience overall. When I first started, I was traveling quite a bit. My title was training manager, and so I was responsible for training new employees on the general basics of the company and things about the company. And I was responsible for going out or sending the people that worked for me out to train those people at the dealerships how to use the software so they could run it efficiently. So in the beginning, I was traveling more than I wanted to, but I did have an opportunity to train in Springfield, Virginia, which was just a few miles from where my brother Brett was living at the time. And I got to train down in the Houston, Texas area. And my sister Cindy was living in Spring, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. So I got to assign myself to a couple trips that I got to see family too, which worked out pretty good. But it was still difficult. I hated being on the road so much. Often I would leave home on Sunday and fly to a location, train all week, get home either Friday night or Saturday morning. And it got to be old. I'd call Donna every night and be homesick. And we didn't have any kids at that time. And then about a year into that or so, I guess a couple things. I remember sitting in the bar in Springfield, Massachusetts, and although I'm not a drinker, I just had to do something where there were a few people around. And I was sitting in a bar and watching the Twins on TV and eating Lando Lakes butter. That's like made me feel like I was almost like home. But one of the things about the travel, too, was it was difficult because I would train people from 8 to 4 or 5, and typically then there was most of the museums and cool things that I could have seen in these cities were closed at that time, and there was nobody to see them with anyway, so it wouldn't have been as much fun. So I didn't do much except I'd go for a run and come back and eat dinner. But it was difficult. Well, on June 1st of 1995, I came into work and my boss said to me, well, we're going to lay off a bunch of people and you're the first one. So they wanted to go public and they wanted to reduce their payroll so they could look more attractive to potential buyers. So in a very short time, they cut 200 employees. They sold it to a German company. I don't remember that company's name, but it was kind of a shocker, and I knew it was coming because about 2 weeks before that, a lady named Julie, who we were friends with when we were in Mankato, asked if we could have lunch together. She worked at the company. So we went to have lunch together in the cafeteria, and she started telling me about this exciting new job she was going to be getting. And the exciting new job included about half the job duties that I was currently doing. So I suspected something was up, And 2 weeks later, it happened that I was laid off. They gave me a couple months severance, which was generous, but I was unemployed, and I had a child at that time, and foster kids too, but we had our own child at that time, so that was a little bit stressful. I went to work, I went home, and my wife was there, and I cried, and after I cried, I thought, I'm going to go find a job. So I went and talked to somebody in the Mankato School District that I knew. He said, yeah, I got something you could do for at least the summer. So I was going to be half-time administrator in the summer school program and half-time teacher. And that was for 6 weeks, so I had a job for 6 weeks anyway. And it paid well, and so, again, for 6 weeks at least, we were covered. And plus, I was getting severance from my previous job, a couple months severance, so... That job led into me being hired to work at a place called the Mankato Model School. There was a program that had been set up, the Minnesota Department of Education and the Mankato School District partnered on a project to start a school for chronic truants. And the kids that went to this school were kids that had been skipping school at their previous school. And most of them were court-ordered to be there. Some of them were threatened with other things if they didn't do that. So either way, they were kind of assigned to the school, not something they really wanted to do. But so I worked there for 2 years, and it was located in the basement of the law enforcement center. So the kids called it the jail school. And if they didn't come to school, we called upstairs to their probation officer, and the probation officer would go and find them and bring them to school. So, you know, when you're trying to be a teacher, and, you know, you like kids, and you even like those kids... It was hard to get them to believe what we were trying to do was important to them, because they hated school. They had come to hate school for whatever reason. So we had some ups and downs, but near the end of my second year, the school district was originally MDE had picked up a big part of the tab for that program, and each year they were stepping back. They're part of it, and the district was having to pick up more and more. And I was a $10,000 savings because they got rid of me and brought in a brand new young guy. And so I was unemployed for the second time in 2 years, and now we had two children. So that was a little bit stressful for me and our family. And then... I was unemployed from about the middle of June till about the middle of August. I went to the unemployment office and I did all the stuff you're supposed to do, and I was sending letters out, and people were just telling me that, no, we're not going to hire you because, you know, we'll put some time and effort into you and then you'll go back to becoming some kind of an educator, and we've wasted our time and effort. So I couldn't get a job. And I didn't tell you junior high principal prior to that, so I was not only a little bit more experienced, but had also been an administrator, and again, I couldn't get a job. It was very frustrating. I saw something in the paper about a position at an elementary school up in Henderson, Minnesota, which is northeast of Mankato, right off Highway 169, and I applied for it, and they contacted me, and the position was called building team leader. But it was really a principal position. I wasn't licensed yet because, remember, I went to graduate school and fell on my face and I hadn't gotten my license. But I had the experience. I had already been a principal. The day I got the phone call, our daughter Lindsay I got the phone call on probably the 1st of August or so. She was born on March 13th, so she was a few months old. Lindsay had never, ever rolled over. And I set her on the couch to answer the phone. And I'm on the phone, and all of a sudden, I hear crying. My daughter Lindsay had decided to roll over for the first time without anybody seeing her, and she was on the floor. So my baby is crying in the other room, and I'm on the phone trying to convince somebody that, hey, I'm the guy you want. And I had just abused my daughter. So that was kind of weird. But they hired me for the job. And things went very well. I loved the job. The people at the school loved me. I loved the kids. One of the things that I did when I went to the school is I wrote a newsletter kind of introducing myself before school started and told them about the open house and you should come to the open house. And one of the things that I did is I challenged the kids to approach me and ask me what their name was. I took out the yearbook from the year before and I tried to memorize every name. And I think I did a pretty good job because that night of the open house, I didn't miss any names. And I think that kind of endeared me to a few people just because I made the effort, you know. But it was a great job, a fabulous job. If I could have done that forever and ever, I probably would have. But I couldn't because in the spring of 1999, they made budget reductions. And I was a budget cut. And so for the third time in 4 years, I was unemployed. And now we had three children. Which time it seems like the stakes got bigger. I always told my wife, or I think I've told my wife this, and I know I've told others, I said, I could sleep in a tent. You know, if I had to, I could sleep in a tent and make it work. But I wouldn't expect my wife and children to sleep in a tent, especially at difficult times of the year. But so yeah, it seemed like it was got to be a little more stressful. So the next adventure started. I went to a meeting. Somebody called me on the phone. They knew that I was unemployed. And actually, I was unemployed from then the end of June till about the middle of October. In the middle of October, a guy from our church, his name was Bruce Pope. Bruce contacted me and said, "Hey, you want to work for me for a while?" And I said, "Sure." I mean, MEA weekend that Thursday, I went to work for Bruce. He didn't really need more help. He was just a really, really generous man. An intervention for me at a time when I desperately needed something. And so I went to work for him. We installed windows and doors and redid roofs and did siding and insulation. And we did a lot of stuff. And I knew some of those skills, but I learned a lot working for Bruce. And so a couple months later, I was called by a guy that I knew a little bit. I had coached his daughter. And he said, "There's this meeting of this charter school group that's taking place on December 18th. Now remember this date, December 18th, because it comes a little bit later. That was my mom and dad's anniversary. So I went to this meeting on December 18th, and they started talking about this charter school, and they had just gotten permission from the state of Minnesota to open the charter school, and their goal was to open it in the fall of 2000. Well, they had a meeting on Thursday that I went to, and then I went to another meeting on Saturday, and on Saturday I became part of the board of this future charter school. And then about 3 weeks later, they were looking to hire somebody to get the school up and running. And in theory, that position was going to be a paid position. And I only say that because for the first several months of my time in that position, I had taken out a loan at the bank to pay myself until other funding came along the way. So I applied for the job. The position was called Program Planner and Fiscal Liaison. So anyway, I applied for this job, and there was a college professor that also wanted the job, and I don't know. Not sure why they picked me, but they picked me. Because I had some administrative experience. I had worked in two principal positions at that point. So I went to work for Riverbend Academy, which was, again, is a charter school in Mankato. They've since renamed it to be called Cato Charter School, but we opened the first day. We opened when we were scheduled to open in September. I was working, and my wife hates this time of our life, but and I kind of came to not appreciate it as much as I did at the time, but my good weeks, I would work a little bit less than 100 hours. And I worked as many as 116 hours 1 week. And it was killing me. I mean, it was something I wasn't really aware of. And what made me realize that I probably ought to change my ways, There was another intervention, a person that stepped in to help me realize what was going on. And I had built an office in my basement. I had walled off the end of this long room that we had in the basement. And I would work in there when I was home. And I was home quite a bit. I was just locked up in that room most of the time. I worked on Sundays. I worked in the evenings. I worked all the time. And one day, for some reason, I forgot to lock the door. And my daughter Lindsay was 3 at the time, and she came into the room. And she climbed up on my lap. And I was like in this fog, and I a few moments later, I picked her up and set her on the floor, and I said, "Lindsay, I can't hold you right now." And she didn't leave. She stood there and cried. And then I started crying. It's just like I woke up out of this fog. My little daughter, who just wanted some attention, wasn't getting it. And I consciously made a decision that day that I wasn't going to work more than 60 hours a week, because I wasn't productive working as many hours as I was. I couldn't do all the things that needed to be done. So I figured out that I had to start prioritizing things a bit and not neglect my family. And some of you are used to working 60 hours a week, and some of you would think that would be abhorrent even at that level, but it was very manageable for me compared to what I was doing. And I think after that, in the 21 years that I worked after that, I think I only worked more than 60 hours a week a couple times. I mean, I really worked hard to, I would leave things and go leave work because I was at that level already. And then in 2006, things had changed. Well, I had my license to become a superintendent, and I was interested in that, and talked to my wife about it, and we decided that I was going to try for it. And I had several friends that were superintendents that I had known from earlier times in education, and I said, "What do you have to do to get to be a superintendent? How do you get a job?" And they said, "Well, you have to be willing to move." Well, again, we talked about it, and we had agreed that if something came up, that we'd be willing to move. We'd been in North Mankato for 15 years and in the Mankato area for 5 before that. I was born in Mankato. I knew a lot of people. We had been at the same church for 19 and a half years. I had taught Sunday school for 19 of those years. I mean, we were pretty entrenched. So even to think about leaving was a big deal. Well, I went and I applied for several jobs and had 3 interviews in quick succession. And I said to Donna, I said, "You know, at this point, I don't see any red flags on any of these." And I said, "I'm going to take the first job that's offered to me." Well, one of the positions wasn't being offered. They were having a hard time making a decision about what they wanted to do. One of the interviews I went to with Alex was there. It was on a Saturday, and it was just a dead atmosphere. Just didn't feel any energy from the board at all, and I just thought, that's not going to work. And the third one, I went to the interview, and our pastor in St. Peter, at the church in St. Peter, knew one of the board members, and that interview went extremely well, and I felt really good about it, and they called me on my way home and told me they wanted to offer me the job. So we got a job. I was going to be the superintendent in McRae. And we did that job for 7 years and really enjoyed it. We made some good friends in Clare City. 2 of our daughters live there now. They moved back there because they felt, you know, some attachment, I think, to that community. And housing's less than it is in Wilmer, and for a variety of reasons. But anyway, Clare City was the place I lived for the third longest in my lifetime, for 7 years. So in 2013, my mom was sick, and I was trying really desperately to get back to the Mankato area. My mom and dad lived over there, and we had been there for a long time. We were kind of the kids of theirs that would see them the most often and pay attention and help with the dock and, you know, whatever. Just felt a pull, the need to be back in that area. And I think I interviewed 8 times at districts within 45 miles or so of Mankato. I think I was a runner-up 7 times, and in the top 3 one of the times, and never got offered any of the positions. And it was kind of discouraging. I didn't really understand what was going on, because I really felt God opened all those doors for me to interview, and I just felt for sure I was going to get a job. And then my sister Cindy decided one day, I don't know when she decided, but she announced that she was moving back from Seattle. She had been away from Minnesota since the late 80s, lived in Houston and lived in Seattle, and she was going to come back and take care of Mom. I just felt this weight lifted. I thought, wow, wonderful. That's be nice to see her more often, and she's going to take care of my mom. And she did. She came back and watched, took care of my mom as she was in hospice in her home. And it was a wonderful blessing to me, and again, took some pressure. And Donna said, well, why don't you apply for a position you think would be fun? I didn't know what that meant, but I applied. So I looked on the places where you look for lists of superintendent jobs, and there was a job open at Minnewaska area up in Glenwood. And I applied, and I sent my stuff at 3:58 p.m., and the deadline was 4 o'clock p.m. And I went to the interview, and it went really well. I went back for a second interview, and it went really well. And on the way home, they called me and asked me to come up there. And the first 2 years were wonderful. The next 2 years were more difficult. We started a building project, and I got on the bad side of a couple board members and decided to leave there because it didn't seem to be a good fit for me. I came to Lac-La-Parle Valley, and I interviewed there. And I'm embarrassed to say this, but it's true. I got to be honest about it. Of the places I applied to in 2013 when I was leaving Minnewaska, Lac-La-Parle was my last choice. And I think that's kind of, I think that's how God's worked a lot of times in my life, is that I've poo-pooed something, and he's set me straight. And in fact, this is my job there was really, really wonderful. I'll talk about some things coming up here, but it was a wonderful job. I was very welcomed there and well-respected, and it was good. Two things about times when I opened my big mouth and said stupid things. When I was a freshman in college, I went back to my brother Brett's graduation. He was a year younger than me, in Redwood Falls. And at the graduation, there was a boy graduating. His sister had been in my class, and then this guy named Chris was graduating. His parents were really old, really old. I don't know how old they were, but they were, compared to the rest of our families, our moms and dads, they were really old. I said out loud, I would never do that to my kids, to be so old when they're this age. And yet, in 4 years, I'll be 68, and my son will be 17, and he's graduating from high school. So, again, God had a way of bringing it back. And that's a true story. I'm not elaborating or embellishing on any of it. I said those words, and that's what happened. So I'm 50 years older than Alex, and a little bit more than that. So I'm 64, he's 13 right now. So then the last thing I want to talk about is some health issues. So in 2010, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Diabetes has not been a big deal in my life. It's been managed pretty well. My A1C, if any of you know that thing, has improved almost each time I've been back to the doctor, so that's wonderful. Later in 2010, I had a heart attack on December 18th. Remember that date? My mom and dad's anniversary? My first connection to Riverbend Academy was on December 18th, and I had a heart attack on December 18th of 2010. I was airlifted to Abbott Northwestern, and again, I opened my big mouth one time. I said to the helicopter pilot, as I was under the influence of morphine, not just my usual sense of humor, but I said, my brother was killed in a helicopter crash. But I said, but I'm not worried about flying with you. I'll be okay. I'm sure that gave them a lot of confidence. So anyway, but it was the morphine. It was nothing else. But anyway, a year and a half later, I was out bike riding. I I rode bike quite a bit for several years. I'm hoping to get back into it again this summer. But I was riding, I used to ride from Clara City to Sacred Heart and back. And round trip was 28 miles. And I'd do that in the summer especially. I was doing it, you know, 3 to 6 times a week. And at the start of the season in May, I started riding Sacred Heart and wasn't feeling very well. And kind of felt congestion in my chest, kind of what I did when I, what I felt when I had my heart attack. So I was taking it easy, and the first couple times I turned around and went home, I got to this hill, and it wasn't very steep, but it was, my body didn't feel quite right, so I just turned around. I thought, I don't want to have a heart attack out here or whatever, and went back home. I think the third or the fourth time I went out on that ride, I decided to go slower on the uphill instead of pushing it. And I got at the top of the hill, and I rode to Sacred Heart and back, and things went pretty well. But I knew there was something wrong, and I had a physical, an annual physical scheduled. In all of my superintendent contracts, I had to have a physical every year. So I had a physical scheduled for just a week or two into the future, and talked to my doctor about it. She said, "Well, you should talk to your cardiologist and see what he thinks." Well, I had my physical appointment on a Wednesday, and the following Tuesday I was at the cardiologist's. Somebody came from Abbott to Wilmer, where I was doctoring at the time, and had a chat with him, and he said, "Well, I'm going to be up at Abbott next Monday. You should come up there, and we'll run some tests." So I went to Abbott the following Monday, and we ran some tests. He said, "Well, there's a blockage that we know of for sure, and he said, we can fix that with the stent." I had had 2 stents placed when I had my original heart attack. He said, "It appears that there's scar tissue around one of the stents that you have, but we can stent that again." So we went back on Wednesday. Donna came with me. We went on Wednesday, and I was supposed to be there at 5 in the morning, so we had stayed overnight. And after the angioplasty, they stick a catheter up through your groin, up into your heart, like electrical wire. I mean, I don't know if they're going to shock me or what, but anyway, they did that, and they said the procedure wasn't going to work. So Donna was sitting right beside me on my right, and I said, "So what are the options?" Oh, a more important thing than anything I've said about this is that on the Sunday before my physical, I asked for prayer. I walked to the altar, and the pastor prayed for me in the church in Wilmer that we went to. And I was really nervous because I thought, something's wrong here. And he prayed for me, and I just felt really a lot of peace about all of this. Actually, it was a Sunday before I had the testing done at Abbott, not the Sunday before my physical. But anyway, he prayed for me, and I really felt at peace. So when the cardiologist said, the stent's not going to work, I said, "Well, what are the options?" And he said, "Well, open heart surgery." And I fully expected that answer. I had taken cardiovascular physiology as a graduate course at Mankato. I knew about the heart. I knew about how things worked. And so when he said open heart surgery, that didn't really trouble me. And again, I was at peace about the whole thing. The next part kind of threw me off. So I said, you know, in my mind I was thinking, well, that'll be, you know, it's not an emergency situation. I'm not having a heart attack. It'd probably be 6 to 8 weeks out, you know, something like that. So I said, "Well, how soon could that happen?" He said, "Well, we have an opening tomorrow morning." And as disrespectful as I can be at times, I didn't turn to my wife and say, "Is that okay with you?" I simply said, "Let's do it." So I'm not sure how she felt about that at the moment, but I should have at least acknowledged that she was in the room with me, and I didn't do that. And for that, I apologize. But and I've apologized before. But so the next day I had open heart surgery, and then started the worst 30 days of my life. I don't know if it was the worst, but it was right up there with some of the worst days of my life. My son at that time was 4 years old, and they told me not to lift anything. Well, my son's standing in front of me and wants to sit in my lap, so I lift my son on my lap, and a minute later he wants to tell me something, so he goes, "Dad, coon." Notice the elbow right in the chest. Ah! And I was like, "A Man Called Horse." Anybody ever see that movie? It was kind of like that. It was painful. Got through that. Went back to work. I took some time off that summer, but not a lot. And I was supposed to walk every day. So, yeah, it was. I was this hunched over guy thing. Oh, Jesus, thing feels crummy. But I got through it. And now my son Alex is jealous of my scar on my chest. But I told him, you don't really want to go that route, so stay away from that. So I started having some difficulties here at Lacaparle Valley. Many of you saw me last summer and probably saw the state that I was in. I couldn't stand during the service. I could stand for a song or two, but I couldn't stand the whole time. My hip was hurting really badly. My back was hurting really badly. Almost everything was hurting quite a lot. And on August 6th of 2020, I was sitting at my desk at school, and all of a sudden it seemed like blinders were coming on me. It was getting black on the edges here, and I could only see straight ahead. I could only see stuff straight ahead. There was no peripheral vision at all. And it reminded me of when I had my heart attack in Bird Island, Minnesota, back in 2010. Then the black receded, and I felt a little better. I hadn't been up and down, so it wasn't a blood pressure. I don't know what it was. We never figured out what it was. But I knew there was an issue, and I contemplated calling up to the front office and asking one of the ladies to drive me into town. I contemplated calling 911 and having an ambulance come, but I didn't know how much that cost, so I didn't do that. So I decided to drive myself to the emergency room here in town. So I did. Got to the emergency room, and I said what I just told you. Things were like this, and I said it was similar to my heart attack, and my cardiologist always said, you got something going on, get it checked out. Don't ignore it. So I was in the emergency room. They ran some tests and did some stuff and couldn't figure anything out. And the doctor that was on call that day was Dr. Freeman. Dr. Freeman comes from Staples, Minnesota. He has a daughter that lives in town here. I don't know what her name is. And it was obvious to me after a short time that Dr. Freeman is a Christian. And I told him about my previous heart attack and my open heart surgery. And he's a cardiologist and a regular MD. I mean, but he specializes in cardiology. And he said to me, you know, this is probably the second time that God's tapped on your shoulder and giving you some kind of a hint about stuff. So again, that intervention that I talk about. Dr. Freeman was there. He was an interventionist in my life. And he said, it might be time to quit doing what you're doing. And I took those words to heart. And by the end of September, I had told three of my board members who were negotiating a new contract with me negotiated a new contract with me, a three-year contract, that I was going to resign at the end of the school year. I figured I could make it to the end of the school year. I realize it's 12:01, and I'll finish up here quickly. So that was in September of 2020, and then things got worse. 2021 was a very difficult year, mentally and physically, for me, but after I retired, I was having lots and lots of symptoms of what turned out to be Parkinson's disease. Maybe some of you noticed, but I was shaking a lot. My legs were shaking. My hand was shaking. I was having a difficult time. There were times during the day and week where I would have trouble speaking. My lip felt really weird, like Novocaine. It felt to me like my speech was slurring. I had to work extra hard to enunciate. I was having trouble typing. I don't know what my fastest typing speed was before, but I'm sure I was in the 70 to 80 word range or somewhere in there. I could always type pretty well. I took typing in college, so I could do well with that. And a lot of my work was typing reports and press releases and memos and emails and whatever, and it became physically difficult for me to type anything. And that kind of takes your confidence down a notch. You're 17, and I was really struggling with being able to do my work, feeling like I was worth what they were paying me each day, and really just not even wanting to sit down and type anything. But I had to type stuff. And it would take me 2 to 4 times longer to do something that should have just been a short time. It was really, really hard. And I was having a lot of difficulty with anxiety, partly because of the stress I was putting on myself about my performance or lack of performance or what I was feeling inside. And it was just really hard. So I went home after retiring on June 30th, and I sat in front of the TV for 2 months and watched every Western that was out there. I even saw a couple for the second time. Channel 46, Channel 105, Channel 93 on my TV all have Westerns most of the day. And I watched about every Western I could find. And finally, and I don't know what really prompted me, finally, maybe when we went to family camp up at by Ortonville, I was really struggling that weekend, just really terrible. I was having a time, I was just having a time. But anyway, right around the second week in September, I decided it was time to do something. Because I had told people when I retired, before I retired, that I was going to really work hard on 2 things. I was going to try to improve my health, and I was going to spend more time with my son. Because he's at a pretty impressionable age and kind of a big deal for me to be around. Again, I felt so crappy all the time that I just didn't want to do anything. Decided I needed to do something. So I went to the clinic and I talked to Paul Hodge. I don't know if any of you know him. I think he's a wonderful man. He's a certified nursing or nurse practitioner and an RN. And I spilled my guts to Paul like I've just done to you about all the things that were going on. I mean, practically everything hurt. And again, my confidence was probably at close to an all-time low. And Paul took the bull by the horns, and within a week or so, I had several appointments with specialists that they don't even have in-house, but to come there. He had set me up with all these people, urologist, neurologist, you name it, he set me up with them. And the appointments were wonderful. I ended up, as a result of that, doing a bunch of things in-house here. I had an MRI, I had a CT scan, I had EKGs. I went to Avera in Sioux Falls for a neurology appointment. I went to, I went to Mayo later on. But all of those things happened in short succession. And each of those appointments made me feel more confident that I could regain much of my previous life. And in 2021, I had 47 medical appointments. And I had 44 physical therapy or occupational therapy appointments. And then my wife and I were very confident that I had Parkinson's, but nobody had told me that yet. I had been over to Wilmer where I normally had doctored, and they told me I didn't have it because something that I described wasn't typical for somebody with Parkinson's. And yet when we looked online and we looked at the symptoms for Parkinson's, I was like the poster boy with these symptoms. They were all things that were going on with me. So again, when Paul Hodge set up an appointment at Avera in Sioux Falls, we went to that appointment. The doctor, he's a specialist, and his intern or whatever that person's title was, spent about 45 minutes with us, Donna and I, and then they left the room. And the doctor came back and he sat just a little ways from me and he said, "You have Parkinson's." And, you know, as much as I kind of didn't want to hear that, I wanted to know what was going on so we could deal with it. Whatever there was to be able to do with it, we wanted to be able to get on with it. And that was really freeing. And that was on October 15th, which happened to be my dad's birthday. A lot of things happen on birthdays in my family. And I have a nephew born on Valentine's Day, and my mom died on Thanksgiving Day, and you know, a lot of dates, it's always out there. But so my diagnosis was real, and we started on pills that day. I had my hip replaced on November 8th, and that was another godsend. Man, it's been wonderful for me to just get that pain to not have to focus on that at all. I can walk mostly straight now, and We went to Mayo Clinic on December 15th or December 16th, and were there for 5 days. Had, I don't know, 14, 15 appointments or something during that time period, and they confirmed most of what we had heard already, and we met with a neurologist, and the neurologist said, well, you've got these pills. He said, I would play around with the dosage a little bit. You can't overdose on this stuff. But he said, you should incrementally go up a little bit from one pill 3 times a day to work your way up to 3 pills 3 times a day and see how where it is that seems to feel the best and stop your tremors and all that stuff. And so within a few weeks' time, I was up to 3 pills 3 times a day, and that's the dose that I'm at now, and it seems to be going pretty well. I don't have tremors very much anymore. I don't have any trouble with my lip anymore. I feel good most of the time. Something that I forgot to mention was that the church board prayed for me the day before we went to Sioux Falls for that appointment with Avera. And I know in my heart that it made a difference. It made me feel better, for one, gave me confidence that there were people on my side, gave me confidence that God was watching over us. And it just gave me a lot more peace about it than what I was feeling, even though Paul Hodge was totally a godsend. So, to wrap up, finally, I want to thank God for his grace. When I was a ninth grader, I was in confirmation class. And one of the assignments was to write our obituary. Don't remember much about that. I don't think I wrote that I was going to be a jerk in my adult life, but I do remember one thing about it, that I said I was going to live to be 120 years old. And I've got 56 years to go. A little bit less, but... So I'm just saying to you now, most of you won't be at my funeral, but... Not to be disrespectful to you, but I feel good about where I'm at. I feel that God has always been in my corner. I mean, I've known it most of the time. I didn't have to look back to see that he was there. I've known that at the time. But there have been a few times when I was like, and I would never, ever have thought to blame him. I just wasn't paying enough attention to him to know that he was there all the time. And I'm not going to forget all that he's done for me. So the last thing is that I wanted to thank anyone who has ever prayed for me and my family, because it makes a big difference.